60 Minutes, coming up next.
Squarespace makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. It's the all-in-one platform that really is easy to use. Building a website is as easy as drag and drop. You can use drag and drop to add content from your desktop and even rearrange elements of content within a page. For a free trial and 10% off your first purchase, go to squarespace.com and use the offer code 60 minutes. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look great on every device every time. It starts at just $8 a month and includes a free domain name if you sign up for a year. You can also use Squarespace to easily connect your new website to Twitter, Facebook, Pinterest, and many more web and social services. For the best way to build your own site quickly, go to squarespace.com and use offer code 60 minutes. That's offer code 60 minutes.
We all know that sex matters, but we're now finding out just how much sex matters when it comes to medicine and science. One significant example, research raises questions about whether prescription drugs should be dosed differently for men and women.
Does that tell you that we really need to go back and review?
Yes.
What, everything?
Pretty much everything.
Tonight, what you need to know about these findings and what may or may not be changing.
Wow, man.
Giving away apartments to homeless people like Robert McMurtry.
This is great.
Who's been living on the streets for years may not sound like a wise idea, but it's happening in cities across America.
And now I can go buy me some food and keep it.
So far, 80,000 homeless people have been given homes this way, and there's evidence it actually saves money.
We are paying more as taxpayers to walk past that person on the street and do nothing than we would be paying to just give them an apartment.
When we interviewed Philip Seymour Hoffman in 2006, he was about to win the Academy Award.
If you can go to the theater and you're in a room with a bunch of other people and what's happening in front of you is not happening, but you actually believe it is. If I can do that, I've done my job.
Hello, my name is Truman Capote.
He was both in talent and temperament a true artist and one of our greatest actors. Tonight, you'll hear him talk about his life, his work, and his demons.
In fact, you went into rehab at a fairly early age.
Yeah, I did. I did. I went, I got sober, I was 22 years old. And I was putting myself in situations and predicaments that were dangerous. But I do remember thinking, there's things I want to do. You know, there's things I want to do.
I'm Steve Croft.
I'm Leslie Stahl.
I'm Morley Safer.
I'm Bob Simon.
I'm Anderson Cooper.
I'm Scott Pelley. Those stories tonight on 60 Minutes.
Early last year, the Food and Drug Administration made an unusual and surprising announcement. It cut the recommended dose of the most popular sleep drug in the country, Ambien, in half for women. It turns out men and women metabolize Ambien, known generically as Zolpidem, very differently, leaving women with more of the drug in their bodies the next morning, and therefore at a greater risk of impaired driving. Ambien, Zolpidem, is now the only prescription drug in the country with a different suggested dose for men and women. But we've discovered it is far from an isolated example of differences between the sexes we never imagined. More and more, scientists are realizing that the differences are dangerously understudied and that pervasively and fundamentally, sex matters. Take aspirin. Low-dose aspirin lowers the risk of heart attacks in healthy men, but in healthy women, turns out it doesn't, though it does protect women against stroke. And drugs are just the beginning. Sex differences have been found in pain receptors, liver enzymes, even the wiring of the brain.
We have generated just a ton of information that suggests that there's sex differences everywhere.
Larry Cahill, a neuroscientist at the University of California, Irvine, used to share his field's assumption that males and females outside the reproductive system were fundamentally the same. but he's changed his outlook 180 degrees. Ambien, he says, is a case in point.
Ambien, prescribed 40 million times just last year.
Mm-hmm.
Approved 20 years ago. We're only now finding out that women have been prescribed a dose that's twice as high as they need.
That is a textbook example of what's wrong. How did it happen that for 20-some years, women, millions of them, were essentially overdosing on Ambien?
The FDA says it made the change after new driving simulation studies established what amount of Ambien or Zolpidem in the blood the next morning could be dangerous for driving. Dr. Sandra Queter, deputy director of the FDA's Office of New Drugs, says only then did they realize women could be taking too much, since women metabolize the drug differently than men.
So if I took Zolpidem and my brother took the same dose, probably the maximum level of drug in my blood would be 45% higher than his maximum blood level.
Now that sounds substantial.
It is substantial.
But we discovered that that 45% difference between men and women had been known to the FDA all along. In the original FDA review of Ambien back in 1992, there was a page called Effect of Gender, where the FDA reviewer noted that two key measures of how much drug is in the bloodstream were approximately 45% higher in females than in males.
It appears to say that they found a significant difference in how this drug is being processed in the body, and then the question is, what did they do with that? And the answer appears to be, they rationalized it away.
I'm going to hand you that page, Effect of Gender.
Okay.
The FDA reviewer went on to write, the results suggest a gender-related difference. However, the lack of specific details, such as study design and individual data, make it difficult to draw a definite conclusion. So when you see that they didn't give you enough data, did you go back or should you have gone back and said, okay, what was the study design? What was the data?
If I saw this today, in light of today's science,
yes,
I think we would go back and try to tease this out a little bit further. But I think at the time, this was generally, this was sort of business as usual for what you saw in clinical pharmacology studies.
That's because, she says, there was no evidence at the time that the difference mattered. That was 20 years ago, when if someone said women's health, it usually meant what they call bikini medicine, breast and ovarian cancer, pregnancy, menstrual cycles. But for parts of the body men and women share, hearts, kidneys, the brain, most of the studies were done predominantly on men.
If you want to understand me, they study you.
And here's why they do that. Because there's this assumption that you are me with pesky hormones.
Oh, with pesky hormones.
I'm being only partially facetious. The idea is that the fundamental things are similar between you and me. So that, ironically, the best way to study you is to study me. Because when
you don't have pesky hormones.
Right. We're studying all the fundamental things in you without this sort of nuisance stuff. That's literally an assumption on which all of biological medicine, especially neuroscience, which I know best, has been built.
But given what we now know, he says that assumption has to go. Look at heart disease, which is the leading killer of both men and women.
Okay. Sorry. That's
okay. Cardiologist Noelle Barry-Murs from Cedars-Sinai Medical Center in Los Angeles says women, like her patient Pearl Grumet, can differ from men in the way they have heart attacks.
I had this excruciating pain in between my shoulder blades, and then I got the nauseous feeling in my stomach.
So the man comes in, he has chest pain, sometimes a radiating pain down the left arm.
Mm-hmm.
The woman comes in. She might
says,
be having stomach upset. She might be feeling fatigue. She might just be short of breath. Why does she even go?
Because they don't feel right, and they know something's
they
wrong.
They know something's wrong. Did you ever have chest pain in this whole time?
No. You can see here's the constriction.
Typically, men get clogs in major arteries that are easy to see on an angiogram. But many women get blockages in tiny microvessels inside the heart. So their heart disease is more often missed.
You are having a heart attack.
Pearl had four minor heart attacks. Five different hospitals couldn't find the problem.
Doctor comes in and he says, when you find out what's wrong with you, would you please let me know? Because we don't have any idea what's wrong.
Dr. Barry Murs says one of the reasons we haven't learned more about women goes all the way back to the beginning of the scientific pipeline to research on animals.
Oh, my goodness gracious me.
Dr. Melina Kibbe is a vascular surgeon who also runs a lab at Northwestern University Medical School, where she evaluates new therapies in mice and rats.
If I walked into a lab anywhere in the country doing animal research, what are my chances of coming upon a study with only male animals?
Very large.
Today?
Correct.
Turns out female rats also have those pesky hormones.
So to control for that variable, most researchers study just males. I was also studying just males.
So it made sense, or you maybe didn't even think about it?
I didn't even think about it.
And neither did Doris Taylor, a leading stem cell expert at Texas Heart Institute in Houston, until she was designing an experiment in mice to see if injections of stem cells could reverse plaque buildup in their arteries. And she needed a way to track the stem cells in the animals.
So what we decided to do is give female animals male stem cells because we could track the Y chromosome. And we said, let's give male animals female cells.
You only did it so you could track the cells.
So we could track the cells.
She was surprised to find the results were not the same.
The male animals we gave female cells got better. And the female animals we gave male cells actually got a little worse.
Oh, only the female stem cells got rid of the plaque.
And you can see all this fat here, the pink.
The male mouse artery on the left had not been treated. The one on the right got female stem cells.
And look at that.
It's clean.
I am embarrassed to admit that as a woman, it had never really occurred to me that doing the experiment in male versus female animals would give completely different results.
And that led to further discoveries. Taylor wanted to find out if human stem cells were different too, and she's found that they are.
My stem cells are actually different stem cells from a man's.
Yes.
She told me men's are less powerful to begin with, and then they start to die off.
In men, as they age, they decrease pretty dramatically, and in females, they stay relatively stable. Now, think about that.
Wow.
Men develop heart disease much earlier than women. Why not look at the difference and see how to make men live longer without heart disease?
She speculates that ignoring this difference may be one reason stem cell treatments haven't lived up to their promise. And on a broader level, that not studying both male and female animals results in more problems for women down the road.
If the whole darn pipeline is male-dominated and sex differences truly do matter, how can it not be the case that you're going to end up with, on average, a lot more negative side effects in women than in men? I mean, it basically has to happen.
And it does. A GAO report found 8 of the 10 prescription drugs withdrawn from the market from 1997 to 2001 posed greater health risks for women than for men. Today, when it comes to government-funded studies on humans, women must be included by law. But many researchers don't then take the next step and analyze the results by sex, which some argue defeats the whole purpose.
We have come upon studies where they do use both male and female, but they then don't analyze how the two respond differently.
So
they have the two and no analysis of the difference.
If you do the two together and you really think females are here and males are here or vice versa, then you're going to get results that are right here.
And so they're almost
useless. They're almost not predictive of either males or females.
If you're clumping men and women together in your study, and there truly is a sex difference, you're not just harming the women. You're harming the men. You're muddling up the understanding of what's going on. You're muddling up the path to clear treatment, not just for the women, but for the men as well.
The problem, he says, is that the scientific establishment hasn't caught up with its own discoveries.
If science got Ambien so wrong,
mm-hmm.
does that tell you that we really need to go back and review
Yes.
what?
everything?
Pretty much everything, yeah. Is once you see this difference, and that difference, and that difference, and that difference, and that difference, and you see this thing's everywhere, you go, wait a minute. So the assumption we're making that it really doesn't matter, sex, is not a valid assumption. It may not matter. It may matter hugely. It may flip your results on their head, and you don't know. So what happens is you start to realize, wow, the status quo is not okay. The way we're doing business has to change.
There are scientists who yes. say the Ambien mm-hmm. situation is like a wake-up call. It's a tip of the iceberg. So should the FDA go back and look at other drugs?
Well, you know, to say every drug, go back and look again,
yeah,
that's an enormous undertaking.
So can women feel secure that the dosages recommended on any of their medications is proper for them? Or should they now be a little worried?
In medical practice, there is a general awareness that there may be individual differences among patients and that every patient needs to have the right dose.
How's a doctor supposed to know?
You start at the lowest dose and you see if it's enough.
Yeah, but you're doing the studies, and they're going to rely on your recommendation. Yeah. It sounds like the FDA is being more reactive than aggressive about this.
I think we're being very aggressive about bringing the most sophisticated science to new drugs and being aggressive about applying the science where we have reason to believe there is a concern to older drugs.
The FDA told us it is looking at other sleep drugs for possible sex differences, but not mounting an across-the-board review. As of today, Zolpidem remains the only drug on the market with different recommended doses for men and women.
You know, if you're a guy, there's only one thing that's worse than forgetting Valentine's Day. Wait, there's nothing that's worse than forgetting Valentine's Day. So don't forget it. In fact, make yourself look like a superstar this year. Get 100 blooms of love with a free glass vase for just $19.99 from proflowers.com. That's right. And for just $9.99 more, you can upgrade and add gourmet chocolates and a teddy bear. All you have to do is use the promo code 6060. You get 100 gorgeous, colorful blooms, a huge bouquet, and if you upgrade, you get the chocolates, the teddy bear. You're a superstar. You're in. ProFlowers is quick and easy, and they guarantee delivery on Valentine's Day. And even if you've already made plans, the flowers, the chocolates, the teddy bear, we'll put it right over the top. Here's how you do it. The only way to get this amazing Valentine's Day deal, go to proflowers.com, click on the blue microphone in the top right corner, and type in 6060. That's proflowers.com, click on the microphone, type in 60.
Giving apartments to homeless people who've been on the streets for years before they've received treatment for drug or alcohol problems or mental illness may not sound like a wise idea, but that's what's being done in cities across America in an approach that targets those who've been homeless the longest and are believed to be at greatest risk of dying, especially with all of this cold weather. They're people who once might have been viewed as unreachable. But cities and counties affiliated with a movement known as the 100,000 Homes Campaign have so far managed to get 80,000 of them off the streets. Local governments and nonprofit groups do most of the work. The money comes mostly from existing federal programs and private donations. And there's evidence that this approach saves taxpayers money. If it sounds too good to be true, well, take a look at what's been happening in Nashville, one of the latest cities to join the 100,000 Homes Campaign.
You awake, buddy?
Robert.
In a storage facility on the outskirts of Nashville, outreach worker Ingrid McIntyre introduced us to Robert McMurtry.
Good morning. Hey. I want to introduce you to my friend Anderson.
She'd come to ask him some questions about his health.
How many times have you been to the emergency room in the past 3 months?
Twice.
Robert told Ingrid he had a lot of medical problems, HIV, hepatitis C, and throat cancer. He was getting treatment at Vanderbilt University Medical Center, but living in this storage locker without a toilet or running water. He bathed in a stream by the side of the road. He said he'd been homeless for 3 years.
How old are you?
I'm 48.
48. I'm 46, so we're 2 years apart. It's nice to see someone else with gray hair.
He said he used to work in the construction business, but fell on hard times after he lost his job and became ill. A friend took pity on him and allowed him to stay in this storage locker for the past 3 months.
I never imagined I'd ever be homeless because I had I really worked really hard my whole life. And it was just devastating, really, when it happened, because I never imagined that I would be in this condition.
Ingrid McIntyre runs a nonprofit called Open Table Nashville. It's been working with the 100,000 Homes campaign to survey the city's homeless and identify those at greatest medical risk.
Do you think he's at high risk?
I mean, he's one of the most vulnerable people that I know.
3 days after interviewing Robert, she returned with an offer that was hard to believe.
Do you want to have an apartment for you tomorrow?
Good.
Do you want it?
Yes. I do, really.
Good.
The following day,
wow, man.
Robert moved in to his very own apartment.
This is great.
It's in a private building in downtown Nashville. You wouldn't have to bathe in that stream anymore. The apartment has one bathroom, one bedroom, and access to this rooftop pool. Until fairly recently, someone like Robert would have to jump through a series of bureaucratic hoops and go through a treatment or job training program before getting permanent housing. The 100,000 Homes campaign advocates using an approach first developed in New York in which the homeless are given housing first.
What we're really aiming for in this movement is that person that's been on the streets, many cases for decades, who you walk past and you're like, oh, I can't even imagine this person being able to be in housing.
The hardcore homeless.
The hardest core of the hardest core, who also happen to be at the highest risk for dying on the streets.
Becky Canis works for a group called Community Solutions, which created the 100,000 Homes campaign. She says most of the 600,000 people who are homeless in the United States on any given night are on the streets for relatively short periods of time, usually less than a month. But it's the chronic cases, people homeless for more than a year, who Canis says are most in need of help.
They're out of friends who will let them sleep on their couch. They're out of friends who will help them get a job. They've burned the bridges of the friends, or they just didn't have them in the first place.
More than 60% of the chronically homeless have drug or alcohol addictions. 30% suffer from severe mental illness. Canis says many of these people have such serious medical problems, it costs taxpayers more to leave them on the streets.
How is it costing more?
The inability to tend to your basic health care needs results in people on the streets ending up in emergency rooms and ending up in inpatient hospitalizations. And one night in the hospital is a whole month's rent in most places.
So you're saying it's more expensive to allow a chronically homeless person to live on the streets than it is to actually subsidize an apartment for them?
Yes, we are paying more as taxpayers to walk past that person on the street and do nothing than we would be paying to just give them an apartment.
Becky Canis began working for the 100,000 Homes campaign after a career in the military. She's a West Point graduate and former Army officer who worked with the Special Operations Command.
Do you think having a military background helps?
I absolutely think it does. It's boots-on-the-ground intelligence that I think is one of the defining factors.
To get that boots-on-the-ground intelligence, the 100,000 Homes campaign encourages teams of volunteers and outreach workers to spend 3 nights looking for and interviewing the homeless. In late May, we joined the teams in Nashville as they headed out at 3 in the morning, searching in small patches of woods, under highway overpasses, and in caves where the homeless camp.
Hey, sorry to wake you. My name's Will.
Those who agreed to answer a series of survey questions would get a free bus pass in return.
How many times have you been to the emergency room in the past 3 months?
About 5 times.
The questions are mainly about their health.
HIV or AIDS.
Liver disease, cirrhosis.
No. History of stroke or heat exhaustion.
The information is used to decide who gets apartments first by giving priority to those at greatest risk of dying on the streets. And the risk is very real. On the steps of this church, a man froze to death last year, one of 52 homeless people who died in the city. Not everything the homeless told the survey teams was accurate. We checked and found some discrepancies. But we were also surprised by the candor of some of the people we met. Ernest Thomas, who has a prosthetic leg, says he once hoped to work in a pharmacy, but ruined his job prospects by getting involved with drugs and crime. He was on parole when we spoke.
Look at me, man. I'm 39 years old, and I ain't got nothing. You know what I'm saying? I don't even call my kids. You know, when I do call them, they be like, Dad, how you doing? I gotta lie and fantasize. Oh, man, I'm straight.
So how do you think you ended up on the street?
Honest with you, man, I couldn't tell you. I really don't know. I messed up. Somewhere I messed up. Yeah.
Will Connolly is director of the city's Homelessness Commission. He's the person who decided Nashville should adopt the 100,000 Homes campaign's approach. He'd already lined up a number of apartments for the people identified by the survey.
And these are fully furnished apartments, ready to go, that these people can just move into.
Yeah, permanent housing, no strings attached, really. As long as they abide by that lease agreement, it's theirs.
The apartments are paid for mostly by the federal government, which gives rental assistance subsidies to veterans and people with low income. The homeless are expected to contribute 30% of whatever income they get from things like part-time work, Social Security, or disability.
Some apartments, like Robert McMurtry's, were provided by civic-minded landlords willing to accept very little rent. Kirby Davis donated 1% of his units and has encouraged other building owners to do the same.
What's the pushback you're getting?
That they might harass my other residents. What are my other residents going to think? What kind of liability do we have?
And what do you say to that?
None of them got to where they are not taking risks. So how about taking a risk for somebody else? Why don't we just go around the room and introduce ourselves?
No new tax dollars were required for Nashville's campaign to house the chronically homeless. A lot was achieved by getting people who don't normally work together, such as outreach workers and private landlords, to focus on the city's most desperate residents.
What I'll do is try to save 2 units, and we'll start with that and give it a try.
To determine who should get apartments first, the homeless who were surveyed got ranked based on their medical risk factors. Robert McMurtry finished high on the list, but there were some in even worse shape.
So who are some of the people you've identified?
The most vulnerable, his name's Frank.
Frank is Frank Clements, who spent more than 30 years in prison for robbery and other crimes. For him and a friend, home was now this park bench.
Where are you guys staying right now?
Right here.
Yeah.
There was a bottle of mouthwash by his side, which is what alcoholics sometimes drink when they can't afford liquor. Frank was 66 years old and said he'd been treated for 2 types of cancer, pneumonia, and heart disease.
How many times have you been to the emergency room in the past 3 months?
About 3 times.
4 days after he answered those questions, he was walking into his new apartment.
This is your new home.
All right. Well, my heart is full of gratitude. You know, it's awesome. I mean, you don't see people like this that help people out, you know?
To try and ensure the homeless don't end up back on the streets, social workers check in on them regularly.
Do you mind if I have a seat?
Oh, of course you can.
Frank Clements needed more help than most. The morning after he got an apartment, we found him finishing off a bottle of whiskey.
I ain't no angel. I'm a damn drunk.
In the weeks that followed, social workers tried to help Frank get treatment. They even drove him to appointments. He'd get sober for a while, then start drinking again, then be filled with remorse. He was so disruptive when drunk, he had to be moved out of 2 different apartments. Some critics of the 100,000 Homes campaign question whether scarce housing resources would be better spent on homeless kids or working poor families rather than somebody like Frank.
Is it fair to give somebody an apartment who's made bad choices and is being irresponsible?
I don't think fairness is the right way to look at it. What I would prefer to look at it is what's good for everybody. So having somebody on the streets, fair or not fair, is costing us as a society, as taxpayers, more than it would cost to have them in housing.
It does seem like you're rewarding somebody, though, who's, you know, drinking or doing drugs or just being irresponsible.
I see it as giving them a second chance, and most people given that second chance do something about those behaviors.
So far, Robert McMurtry has made the most of his second chance. He made friends in his building, and 3 months after he got his own apartment, we were amazed to see him jogging in a nearby park. Researchers at the University of Pennsylvania found that when homeless people in Philadelphia were given housing and support, more than 85% were still in housing 2 years later and were unlikely to become homeless again.
How's it going?
Good.
Everything went great this morning?
Mm-hmm.
I'm so glad. You look awesome.
In September, homeless advocates in Nashville held a luncheon for some of the people they'd helped. In 100 days, they'd gotten nearly 200 people into homes, and all but a handful were still in their apartments. But there weren't enough apartments for everyone. Ernest Thomas didn't get one. He ended up back in prison on a parole violation and then homeless once again. By this summer, Nashville and other communities across the country that have joined the 100,000 Homes campaign expect to reach their goal of getting 100,000 people off the streets. That won't completely solve the problem, but Becky Canis says it will prove that it can be solved and that no one is unreachable.
We have this amazing collection now of before pictures and after pictures that just captures the transformation that's possible once someone's in housing. There's something that's really dehumanizing about living on the streets in so many ways. And then really in a matter of days from having housing, the physical transformation is almost immediate. They're unrecognizable from their former selves. And I don't think that there's anybody once they see that, that would say, well, let's put them back on the streets again.
When the actor Philip Seymour Hoffman was found dead in his apartment last week from an apparent heroin overdose, it came as a shock to all but his closest friends and family. How he came to die that way at the height of his fame is still a mystery, although this was not Hoffman's first battle with drug addiction. He was only 46 years old, but he had already created a lifetime's worth of memorable characters, and the New York Times in a front-page obituary called him perhaps the greatest actor of his generation. He was in talent and temperament and commitment a true artist, intense, introspective, sensitive, and obsessed with his work. He did not often sit still for long interviews, but he did for us back in 2006 as his career was taking off. He just received an Academy Award nomination for Best Actor in the film Capote, and we spent several days in New York and L.A. talking about his life, his work, and his demons.
If you can go to the theater and you're in a room with a bunch of other people and what's happening in front of you is not happening, but you actually believe it is, if I can do that, I've done my job. And that's the thing that is a drug. That's a drug. That's something you get addicted to.
When we talked to Philip Seymour Hoffman 8 years ago, he told us he'd rather people remember the characters he played than remember him. He insisted on meeting us at 8 a.m. in the heart of New York's Greenwich Village, which was the center of his world for nearly 30 years. He went to drama school at New York University and never really left the neighborhood.
So why did you want to do this at 8?
It'd be easier to talk and stuff, mm-hmm. and there wouldn't be as many people around. And
he came dressed as though he might have slept in the park or wandered out of a homeless shelter, yet we still got stopped by an admiring fan.
You deserve the Oscar, Mr. Paul.
Thank you.
He was already a familiar face, having appeared in 40 films in just 14 years.
Get out of the truck now, Sully!
Working with major stars and A-list directors, he'd become famous taking small roles and transforming them into memorable characters. Like the trust fund playboy in The Talented Mr. Ripley.
Absolutely once, child.
Or the pernicious preppy in Scent of a Woman.
He's good cop, bad cop in Us.
Or the gay, curious sound man in Boogie Nights.
Can I kiss you?
Scotty,
please,
I don't...
Please, can I kiss you on the mouth?
No!
Please let me.
Let it ride!
Not to mention various turns as the obnoxious, overweight friend.
I'm just messing with you, Sasquatch. Let's get it on.
And a pre-op transsexual, all of which begged the question about his scruffy wardrobe.
Is this the real Phil Hoffman, or are you now preparing for some other role?
Now, this is me.
He was totally without vanity unless the role called for it. And despite his success at age 38, he was still very much the struggling artist, consumed with the craft of being an actor and grateful for the recognition, yet suspicious of fame and celebrity and how it might change him and what he did.
I think part of being an actor is staying private. I do think it's important. Part of doing my job is that they believe I'm someone else. You know, That's part of my job. And if they start watching me and thinking about the fact that I got a divorce or something in my real life or these things, I don't think I'm doing my job.
You want to be a mystery.
Well, you just want to, you don't want people to know everything about your personal life, or they're going to project that also onto work you do. It's impossible not to. If you know enough about somebody, it's impossible not to. Like my friends who I've grown up with and know me very well, I know they watch my films different than anyone else. I know they come up to me like, oh, that thing you did, that's just like the thing you do. You know, they'll say that. And I'm like, you know, because you want to find a way even to get them to think you're someone else. And when you get that person that knows you that well to think you're actually someone else and lose themselves, then you've really done your job.
Hello, my name is Truman Capote.
It was a challenge he faced every day in what is perhaps his most famous role, his portrayal of Truman Capote, who for 20 years was not only America's most famous writer, but one of its most recognizable celebrities.
Yeah, have you read the article about the killings in Kansas in the front section of the New York Times? I think that's what I want to write about.
The film deals with the 6 years that Capote spent writing In Cold Blood, which would make him famous and in the process ruin his life. The project was developed by two of Hoffman's oldest friends, Bennett Miller, the film's director, and screenwriter Dan Futterman. The three had met when they were 16 years old and knew each other so well they were concerned the film might end their friendship.
This is what Bennett Miller says about you. He works himself into a state of crisis and distress, worrying that people are going to know he's a fraud and that his career is over.
He talks too much, that guy. Well, you do think your career is going to be over all the time. I mean, that's pretty common. Part of my job is actually that it's me. I'm not a painter. I'm not a musician. I'm not these things where actually I'm creating something that then I can distance myself and you can actually experience it. I'm actually the one. It's me, my body, my head, my mind, my voice. It's right here, you know. And there is something about people criticizing that or failing in that realm, and it's actually you they're talking about. That's hard. That's hard to take, and I do fear that, definitely.
Hoffman spent a huge amount of time at Miller's apartment studying old film.
You know that it had that effect on you, personally.
He leans right in there. I mean, the guy's not even looking at him, but he's...
You can make it have exactly the same effect on me.
I mean, look how he adjusts himself to the guy, you know.
Plumbing the depths of Capote's life and his own to try and capture the character and get inside his head. He was worried that the line between parody and perfection was razor thin.
I knew that this was going to be something that the risk quotient was high.
Why was it high risk?
Just the possibility of humiliation.
Yeah, failing was high. Yeah, it was huge. People knew who he was. He's an iconic figure. Being embarrassingly bad in the role was very real.
Just researching this work has changed my life.
How did you identify with him?
The ambition, the drive, the wanting to be the center of attention, the wanting to succeed.
Those are all you?
Yeah, they're all inside me somewhere.
Hoffman grew up in a middle-class household near Rochester, New York. In high school, he was a clean-cut, competitive jock who excelled in baseball and wrestling, until a neck injury cut short his athletic career and his hormones led him to acting.
This woman that I was just had a mad crush on, she was in high school, walked by the other way. I was like, where are you going? And she's going, I'm going to audition for a play. I was like, you know, and I was like, I think I'll go too. And I turned around, I followed her in, and I auditioned for the play, and I got to be with her every day. You know what I mean? It was like, you're just a teenager and you have a crush, you know? And then all of a sudden, it's not about the crush. And all of a sudden, you realize you like doing theater, and you like being an actor. You like hanging out with these people.
Over time, he applied the same competitive drive he had with wrestling to grappling with roles on stage and screen, steadily building an impressive resume with a stubborn, single-minded zeal for perfection that he was never entirely comfortable with.
If I don't think I'm doing well, I'm unpleasant. That's my neurosis. You know what I mean? If I don't feel like I'm doing the job well and I don't know how to get there or I'm too scared or whatever, I'm not a happy guy and I'm not pleasant. I'm not pleasant to be around.
You feeling all right about this?
about talking to you?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Is it going all right?
Okay. Yeah. I, but I, I think that that, yes, actually I do feel right about this. I mean, this is me being pleasant, I hope.
The depth of Hoffman's commitment and his talent are apparent in one of the final scenes of Capote. After 6 years of cajoling, befriending, and seducing two killers into telling him a story that will make him famous, the author says his final goodbyes as they head off to the gallows.
I did everything I could.
Okay.
I truly did.
It took Hoffman 9 months of his life to get the performance just right. And when the shooting was over, he was tapped out and done being Truman Capote.
I immediately started talking like myself, like that. And I thought to myself, I'm never gonna do that again. I'm not gonna act like him anymore.
Why?
Because I was free, first off. So the minute you're able to walk away from that and separate, just you do. I do.
So you can't even do it like one more time?
No, I
like drunk at a party?
That might be, if I start drinking again, you might be able to get me to do it.
That last comment was a small slip for someone who guarded his privacy as closely as Hoffman did. But it told us something about his past.
You said you don't drink.
No, I don't.
In fact, you went into rehab at a fairly early age.
Yeah, I did. I did. I went, I got sober, I was 22 years old. Yeah.
So this was drugs or alcohol or both?
Yes, all that stuff, yeah. Was anything I could get my hands on? yeah, I liked it all, yeah.
And why did you decide to stop?
You panicked. It was, I was 22 and I got panicked for my life. It really was. It was just that. And I was putting myself in situations and predicaments that were dangerous. Even now I think about it, I was so young. I was 22 at the time, but I do remember thinking, there's things I want to do. There's things I want to do. And I'm not going to do them if I keep doing this. It's not going to happen.
So what was rehab like?
It's a lot of things. It is a lot of things, but I wouldn't really get into too much. But
it changed you.
It did, yeah. Yeah, it did. Meaning it was a respite. It was a break. It was something about it that I remember it drastically pulled me out of my life. It did change something. It made me see things differently. It made me see things differently. It gave me this idea that those things you want to do, Phil, those things you want to get done, you can do them.
And he managed to do a lot of them. He won the Oscar for Capote and would be nominated 3 more times.
That's right, Mr. Hoffman!
And there were the triumphs on the New York stage.
Philip Seymour Hoffman is magnificent. I beg you not to miss it. Death of a Salesman.
Friends believe Hoffman began drinking again in 2012 while losing himself in the physically and emotionally exhausting role of Willie Loman in Death of a Salesman. And then he eventually sought escape, revisiting heroin. He was trying to quit, but unable to muster the discipline he found in his work to save his own life. When he was found dead last week, people remembered not just the characters Philip Seymour Hoffman created, they remembered him, especially on The Great White Way, which went dark in his honor.
The best you'll ever feel is when you've done a good job. That's the best you'll ever feel. And that satisfaction is wonderful, because it's a job well done. And I'm grateful for all of it, but I know at the end of the day that when I was shooting Capote or I was shooting any film I've done or done any play, that the day that ended where I felt like I acted well and I went home and I was able to breathe a free breath that was long and deep, and go to bed and my eyes shut and I went to sleep peacefully, that's as good as it gets.
I'm Steve Croft. We'll be back next week with another edition of 60 Minutes.